We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
92.9 FM ESPN presents the area's only national columnist who spends his afternoons bringing unique perspective to Memphis radio. He'll make you think. He'll make you laugh. He'll sometimes make you change the station if children are around. And he apologizes in advance for that. It's 4 o'clock. Let's get into it. This is the Gary Parish Show. Today's special guest host, Jeffrey Wright.
Yeah. Happy Monday to you wherever you may be. As the introduction suggests, my name is indeed Jeffrey Wright. You can follow me on Twitter at JWright929ESPN. I'm joined by my partner in crime, the executive producer of the program, Brett Carson. Good day, sir.
Good day. Good day. Basketball today.
Huge, huge weekend, so let's not waste one single second. Let's tell everyone what's coming up here on the program. Gary Parish is, of course, up in New York City. If you happened to watch CBS Sports Network yesterday, right after Selection Show, you caught all of Gary's analysis on the brackets. We'll discuss that. Of course, all the big Memphis sports stories that occurred over the weekend. We'll discuss all that with him in just a few seconds. Mark Giannotto joins us during next segment. We'll get Mark's thoughts on everything that was the AAC tournament, Penny Hardaway's first year, some coaching rumors and more, some potential scheduling issues, and of course, Mark's thoughts on Jonathan Paul Manziel perhaps being the Lord and Savior of the Memphis Express, I guess, organization. They're not a franchise. They're organization. Jeff Calkins is going to join us at the top of the second hour. We'll get into all matter of things with Jeff when he joins us at 5 o'clock. But let's not waste a single second, because you didn't turn on this dial to hear me drown on. You turned it on to hear Gary Parish. Gary, good day, sir. How are you?
I'm all right. You okay?
I'm doing great, man. Okay, what did you think was a bigger moment for Memphis in terms of just interest, something that made you raise your eyebrows? Was it Memphis making it to Saturday, the AAC tournament, or was it when you saw the Memphis Express were going to have number two flashing the money sign, Johnny Manziel would indeed become a member of the Memphis Express?
Well, I think it depends on perspective. From a national perspective, undeniably, Johnny Manziel being a member of the Memphis Express is a bigger story. You know, it's on ESPN's homepage. It's on TMZ. He is now the most famous professional athlete in our city. It's not even close. I mean, he's a bigger deal than Mike Conley. He's a bigger deal than, you know, international. I mean, maybe not internationally, but certainly nationally, he's a bigger deal than anybody else. He's the most famous person who lives in our city now, and so that resonates outside of the market in ways that nothing else could. But inside the market, it wasn't just Memphis playing Houston in the AAC tournament semifinal. It was Memphis with a shot to send it to overtime against Houston in an AAC semifinal. Obviously, we know how the game ended. Tyler Harris missed a shot, couldn't get another one off, but they had a shot at beating a top 15 team in a way that would have propelled them to an opportunity to play one more game inside FedEx Forum with an automatic bid to the NCAA tournament available to them. And so that was the bigger story in the market. But in terms of what resonates nationally, the Johnny Manziel story is, I don't know how it's going to play out on the field, but it'll be well documented, because he's a real celebrity. He's a celebrity football player that, for whatever reason, people are still, still deeply interested in.
What is it? Because Jeff was trying to ask me, if you had to kind of pinpoint what it is that makes him so interesting, forget the off the field, the Scooby Doo, the good looking girls on Halloween and whatnot. Forget all of that. But because what initially attracted everyone to him was his play on the field. What do you think it is that makes us still interested in Manziel even today?
I'm not sure. Other than he was super interesting to us while he was a college football player, because you got to remember, though he was a name in Texas, nobody really knew Johnny Manziel, that not casual sports fans, until, you know, he was on his way to winning the Heisman Trophy. And then he became not only one of the more, if not the most exciting players in college football, and, you know, I think in just football in general, you could throw the NFL in there. He was such a character off the field that people sort of gravitated to that. You know, there was, beautiful women, and then a wild, personality. You know, he was always out, always partying, perhaps. I think with the benefit of hindsight, we now know too much too often. But, you know, people just sort of, you know, we live in a TMZ world, and he was perfect for TMZ. And if you acknowledge we're interested in people who, live lives sort of on the edge of a variety of things, then he, from a sports perspective, for a little while, fit that better than anybody. And so then it just becomes, I think you initially like him because he's a lot of fun, because he's cocky, and because he's awesome. And then it starts to be about the comeback story. You know, okay, can he get his, forget football career, can he get his life together? Because we do root for people to get it back together, you know, once it falls apart on them a little bit. And that's sort of where we are in the story right now. You know, people want to see this young man succeed, you know, if only because you don't like to, or I think you got to be pretty twisted to like to, you don't like to see people with undeniable talents never reach or achieve what it is they, at least from a talent perspective, seem like they're capable of reaching or achieving based off of issues that they have a problem overcoming. And his problems and issues are well documented. He has publicly acknowledged he has a mental health issue. He has publicly acknowledged he has a substance abuse issue. I don't think we've ever gotten clarity on why he was banned from the CFL, not just let go by a team, but banned from the league. But I can only think of a couple of reasons why you might be banned from the league, and that's if you violate certain policies that they made it clear to you you were not going to be able to be able to violate. And so if you're betting on this to end well, you probably haven't been paying attention since his, you know, since he left Texas A&M. He's still, from a distance, it appears, dealing with some serious things that pop up every once in a while, if not often. But, I'll be rooting for him, not just because I want to see the Express finish the season strong. I don't really care about that. But I am, like a whole bunch of other people, just sort of fascinated by the Johnny Manziel story, and would like to, there have been people close to him who have said on the record that there was a time when he was living a lifestyle that they did not think he would survive. Forget football. They didn't know if he'd live to be 30. And so you want this story to end not tragically, and, the football stuff being sort of secondary, but, you know, as long as he's going to keep going on a football field and trying to get back to where we all thought he would be someday, which is the NFL, I think I'll be rooting for him every step of the way.
Gary Parrish is joining us here on the program. Gary, of course, up in New York. And because you were around the selection shows, and you paid very close attention to the reasoning behind teams that did get in and didn't get in. Jeff, I thought, made an interesting point this morning, and I'm curious to get your take on it. Jeff kind of mentioned how every time Memphis would seemingly have a big loss early in the season, whether it be letting the lead against Texas Tech go, not being able to finish off the comeback against LSU, faltering against College of Charleston, Cincinnati games, letting all of these games go, Jeff kind of pointed out when you looked at it, and Penny Hardaway mentioned, you know, man, these are going to hurt us come tournament time, and everyone's kind of like, dude, your best chance to make it is winning the conference tournament at home. But you kind of have to wonder after last night, and you see it, if Memphis maybe would have held on against Texas Tech, holds on against Cincinnati, would they have been right there in the discussion yesterday?
Yeah, I talked about this, like, in the final week, couple of weeks of the regular season, that if, you know, you can do this. Obviously, you could take a team's resume and say,
sure,
well, if you take these four losses and turn them into wins, they would have been in good
spot. It's a great resume.
Right. But I think with Memphis, you don't have to do anything drastic other than just, okay, hold on against Texas Tech. You know, they were up in the second half. Hold on against Cincinnati at home. And, you know, maybe, you know, don't go down whatever the score was. You know, don't go down by 27 in the first half against South Florida. And then suddenly they're sitting on Selection Sunday at 24-10 instead of 21-13, and they got big signature wins over Texas Tech and Cincinnati. That very, like, just those three things would have, at the very least, put them on the bubble, and maybe would have had them on the right side of the bubble. So, listen, by the time the Selection Show got started, they were nowhere near the bubble. They weren't even under serious consideration. But if they would have just done what we just laid out, hold on against Texas Tech, hold on against Cincinnati, and don't go down by 27 points at USF, win those games, I think on Selection Sunday they would have been one of the teams that, you know, whether it's Jerry Palm or Joe Lunardi or anybody else, is one of the teams they're deciding, do we put this team out or put this team in, that they would have been right there in the first four out, last four in conversation.
You consistently say, hey, they got to put 68 in the tournament. What did you make of the 68 that they put in the tournament this year?
I think the committee did about as well a job as you can do. You know, anybody who follows me on Twitter and was following yesterday knows that, you know, it was probably this time last week, folks were saying Virginia had the number one overall seed locked up. And I was just like, I don't see it. If Zion Williamson comes back and Duke wins the ACC tournament, Duke's going to have an incredible resume without context. But with the context, they're going to be a one-loss team at full strength. And the committee is going to at least acknowledge that. And so I started banging that drum last week. Like, don't give the number one overall seed to Virginia already, because I did think that Duke-Virginia would play in the championship game. It didn't go down that way. But my point was, you're really going to make Virginia the number one overall seed if Duke has that resume with Zion and three wins over Virginia? Like, you're going to make the number one overall seed somebody that went 0-3 against Duke when Duke could be the number one overall seed? So I think more people picked up on that after Zion came back Friday night. And by Sunday, I think everybody was kind of on board. Duke should be the number one seed. But on Sunday morning, I tweeted it should be Duke the number one seed, overall seed, and then Virginia as the second number one seed, and then North Carolina as the third number one seed, and the fourth should be Tennessee. But if Tennessee loses the SEC tournament championship game, it should be Gonzaga instead of Tennessee. And that's exactly what happened, and it's exactly the way it went down. And when I talked to one of the members of the selection committee yesterday, he told me that we had Tennessee as the fourth number one, and they would have been that had they beat Auburn. When they lost to Auburn, we moved them down, moved Gonzaga up. So I had the four number one seeds exactly right. And then, I honestly had the 68 schools exactly right as well. I didn't have them all seeded correctly, but I did go 68 for 68. I don't want to try to pretend like I'm some sort of bracketologist. Like I've said many times, if you understand what's important to the committee and you have access to all the data, we're all going to agree on 66 of the teams every year. I mean, this is not as hard as people make it out to be. You are all going to agree on 66 of the teams, and then you're picking between maybe four teams for those final two spots, maybe five teams for those final two spots. So all I did yesterday afternoon is I took my top 25 and one, put them all in the field, seated in that same order, and then I filled out the rest of the bracket because Joe Lunardi and Jerry Palm had the same 68 schools.
Yep.
But neither of them had Belmont.
Belmont, yep.
And I knew that I wanted Belmont in the field because I had made the case for them, and I thought there was a chance the committee would interpret their resume the way that I interpreted their resume, which is that, no, they didn't have all these quadrant one wins, but in quadrant one / quadrant two opportunities, they had a better winning percentage than most of those bubble teams. And so all I did was put Belmont in the field and then say, okay, now I've got to pull somebody out. And the team that I pulled out was TCU because they had a losing record in Q1, Q2 opportunities. And that just ended up being the way the bracket was. It was included Belmont, didn't include TCU. So as I told the committee last night when they were in studio with us, I think you guys did a wonderful job because what you did is basically exactly what I thought you should do.
Yes, no, I find myself agreeing with myself. It's the greatest move ever. Really proud of you on that. Andy Kennedy used to consistently say whenever we, because as you know, Andy found himself on the bubble quite often. Andy used to say that there's two components to it. There's the eye test and there is the metric test. And if you look at some of these teams, when you compare their net to their RPI, there's a big gap between where they are seated or where they would be standing based on RPI and net. When you now look at, we've had the full year, we've seen what the committee did using the nets pretty specifically and using the eye test, how close do you feel like, where do you feel like we are in terms of getting the best 68 teams using those metrics and using the eye test?
I think the committee is smarter than ever and more willing to look at all sorts of metrics to try to put the field together as best they can. They don't rely on any one number, but they are aware of all of the numbers. And one thing I think that gets lost with the net is that people look at it as a ranking, you know, 1 through 353. They may say, well, if this team's 15th and this other team's 18th, well, then the team that's 15th has got to be better than the team that's 18th. That's just not true. And it's also not the way the committee uses the net ranking. They don't use it. They don't really care who's 7th or who's 14th. It's strictly a grouping tool to be used to label what is a quad 1 victory or a quad 2 victory or a quad 3 victory or a quad 1 loss, quad 2 loss, quad 3 loss. So it's way more important, and Jerry Palm's talked about this all season, it's way more important for your opponents to be great from a net ranking perspective than it is for you to be great from a net ranking perspective. And a pretty good example of that is late in the season when Central Florida cracked the top 30 of the net for the first time.
Yeah.
Because suddenly Memphis had a win over that team, and if you have a home win over a top 30 net team, that is a, quote, quad one win. So Memphis, like, went to bed on a Tuesday night with zero quad one wins, woke up on Wednesday with one quad one win, didn't even play a game. Just all it was based on was Central Florida moved into the top 30. So that's what the net is used for. It's to group teams and sort them so that they can then identify in a way that's visually easily to digest, you know, what this team has done when it's been in its greatest opportunities throughout the season. The one difference between the net and the RPI that I think is worth pointing out, besides that, the net's just better because it's a more complicated algorithm, and the RPI is such a simple, outdated formula that it was long past its time for it to go away. But one of the things the net did, it appears, is that the bottom teams in the power conferences are almost without exception higher in the net than they would have been in the RPI.
Yes.
And so what that does is benefit the Power Five schools that are good or on the bubble, because in years past, maybe a win over Pitt wouldn't qualify as a quad one or a quad two, but it did qualify in a way that registers with your resume, because the bottom of the power conferences, those teams had better net rankings than RPI rankings. And so, you know, if I were, you know, a fan of a mid-major school or an athletic director of a mid-major school, this would be something I would be screaming about. You know, the system is already rigged against the mid-majors. And now you've got this algorithm that the NCAA created that makes it even more tilted toward the power conferences, because they're getting more opportunities to enhance their Q1 games and their Q2 games than they otherwise would, simply because the algorithm now rates the bottom of those leagues better than the RPI ever did. And so I think that kind of got glossed over a little bit because Belmont got an at-large bid and people were like, woohoo! But that system is still very much tilted against everybody outside of the traditional power structure, and it appears it's always going to be that way.
Talking, of course, with Gary.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Parrish, he's up in New York joining us here on the program. Of course, as always, you can follow him on Twitter at Gary Parrish CBS. Okay, there were two other Memphis questions I wanted to get to you first. First, let's start here. Now we know that Memphis will be playing in the NIT tomorrow night. Now that we've seen the complete season, we've seen the start, the finish, everything in between, how do you grade Penny Hardaway's first year?
I mean, I would give him an A, honestly. I mean, because you have to go back to where the program was on the day that he took over and where the program is right now. On the day that he took over, they had about 4,000 people going to games. They had no recruiting class to speak of, no future to be excited about. Fast forward through the season. Oh, and couldn't sniff the NIT, by the way. Finished 161st at KenPom. So the on-the-court product was garbage. Everything connected to the program away from the court was garbage. There was nothing good happening and nothing to look forward to. That's undeniable. It's why I spent, you know, 3 straight months saying they had to make a coaching change. There was nothing – everything was hitting modern era lows. Recruiting, attendance, donations, season ticket sales. And because the staff could not effectively recruit, people were talking about this season. You know, what would next season under Tubby Smith have looked like? Can you imagine losing these players that they're about to lose from because they've exhausted their eligibility and you've got no recruiting class on the way? I mean, because that's what it would have been.
Ugh.
No recruiting class on the way. So it wasn't always that this season was going to be any worse than the season before. It would have probably been comparable. But you were headed nowhere. And so Penny takes that over, immediately enrolls a top 30 recruiting class. Donation season ticket sales spike. Attendance at games spiked. You've got a top 10 recruiting class now on the way, highlighted by the number one prospect in America. You're going to be preseason top 25 next season, and you are playing in the NIT, for the first time in a while. You know, Memphis, I know the NIT isn't anybody's goal when the season starts, but getting there is still better than not getting there. And there was not a time under the 2 years of Tubby Smith where Memphis could sniff what Memphis has now achieved. And when you're able to do in year one what your predecessor couldn't do in year one or year two, you are, I think, by definition, doing a good job. And when really this was always supposed to be just a makeshift year until you get, quote unquote, your players enrolled, to be in this position is, again, if I had to give it a grade, I'd give it an A. You take over a program that's 161st at KenPom, it's 62nd right now. So Memphis has improved by about 100 spots in the past year. In the preseason, they started at 107. They're now at 62. So they improved by, more than 40 points, when it comes to a KenPom rating from November through March 18th. And so the recruiting is at a level that it otherwise wouldn't have been in, and the on-the-court product was significantly better than it had ever been under the previous coach. So I don't know how anybody could be anything other than ecstatic, given the circumstances we're in right now. I know that, when you've got a semifinal game on your home court, 2 wins away from the NCAA tournament, it's disappointing when you don't get there. But once that disappointment eases a bit and you take a step back and look at the big picture, you have to be, there aren't many programs in America that have a reason to be more excited right now than Memphis fans have to be excited about the Memphis program.
How important do you think it is to maintain this coaching staff in order to kind of keep this momentum and sustain it? Obviously, the recruiting and whatnot, but I ask this question for this reason. For instance, often when I covered football teams, I'd hear about the importance of keeping the staff together, And then I'd go, I don't really think that's that important. I mean, I've looked at some of these coaches. If you put them up, they're all kind of replacement-level coaches. I think what is important is to keep all this momentum going, but in terms of actual importance to success for this product, I'm not sure how important this coaching staff is. Although I look at the job that this Memphis staff has done, and I really do kind of buy into the idea they need to keep these guys together.
I like the staff a lot. They have done an incredible job since stepping foot on campus, and they have good reputations with basketball people. You know, I happen to work with a handful of former NBA players, so they know Sam Mitchell, and they all speak highly of Sam Mitchell. Like Wally Szczerbiak, who I work with almost every night, played for Sam, and yep. He's like, Wally, because everything registers in Memphis, sometimes not outside of Memphis. So the first time this season we were talking about Memphis, Wally and I in studio, Wally was like, so Penny hired Sam Mitchell and Mike Miller? He was like, that's an amazing stat. Because, like, Wally knows those guys. He knows that Mike's a smart, you know, a smart guy when it comes to basketball. He knows Sam is a quality coach. So I do think it would be ideal to be able to keep the staff together because they seem to like each other, and they're obviously, you know, getting things done. You know, the product on the court is good and better than it was supposed to be, and the recruiting stuff is top 10 nationally right now. All that said, I think I'm more with you than not on the idea that great head coaches are not a byproduct usually of their staff. Those guys are going to be great regardless. I mean, you look at Mike Krzyzewski's staff right now.
Yeah.
And then compare it to Mike Krzyzewski's staff from 5 years ago. Not the same guys.
Nope.
But Duke is still the favorite to win the national championship. You know, John Calipari has had staff turnover over the years. It's never really mattered. And so I do think having guys you're familiar with and who are good and who you trust around is better than the alternative. But I tend to think, and I say this with all due respect to Mike and Sam and Tony, Penny's the star over there right now. And if you told me I could keep the staff as is, I would. I wouldn't change it at all. But I don't think if he loses a guy or two that it's going to have a massive impact on what's possible under Penny Hardaway at Memphis. My guess is he'd go out and hire somebody or two somebodies that are that are equipped to help him with the things he needs help with, and that Memphis basketball would continue on, as my friend John Rothstein says, an upward trajectory.
And then lastly, we've seen the rumors for Mike Miller to UNLV. I've actually even heard scuttlebutt behind the scenes that, you know, if things could have gone worse for Florida, there might have been a play to try to get Mike back home. In terms of the odds of keeping Mike on staff for this year, how likely do you think it is?
More likely than not, but not 100%,
sure.
Because, you know, his name is connected to some of these jobs, and obviously he's an intriguing candidate. You know, he's got the type of personality that I think you need to be a successful college basketball coach, because a lot of the job is shaking hands and creating relationships, and Mike is you know, he's got that type of personality. Like, he's everybody's friend. Everybody likes Mike Miller. So that, and then from a basketball perspective, like, he understands the game. Nobody disputes that. I don't think he'd have any problem, like, coaching. And, you know, from a recruiting perspective, he's a big name. You know, he's a famous former basketball player who played with LeBron James. He's got connections throughout the sport. So I'm not surprised that he's on, that he's popping up on these search lists for UNLV and various other jobs. I will say, take Mike, set him over here for a second. That's a big, big jump.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the way these things usually go down, where you are an NBA player, retired for a year or however long, and then you're on staff at a Division I university for a year, and now you're coaching, you know, UNLV. Or a comparable program. I'm not saying it won't happen, and I'm not saying it shouldn't. I'm just saying that it would be unusual. But that doesn't mean it would be bad. You know, Penny Hardaway is an unusual hire. Fred Hoiberg at Iowa State was an unusual hire. Steve Kerr with the Golden State Warriors was an unusual hire. So I really, you know, I don't want an athletic department, but if I did, I would never let that kind of stuff stand in the way of me doing something if I believe the guy could do the job. And so that'd be the first thing I'd have to figure out if I were running UNLV. Can this guy do the job that I need him to do? But if I reach the conclusion, yes, I think he can, and there's nobody better I could hire to do it, then I would not have any reservations hiring Mike Miller, even if it is, like I said, a big jump and not the normal way these things work.
GP, we appreciate the time, my man.
All right, brother. I'll see you. Bye.
He is Gary Parrish. When we come back, Mark Giannotto is going to join the program. We'll ask Mark his thoughts on the importance of keeping this staff together, his grades for Penny Hardaway's first season, his thoughts on Johnny Manziel as perhaps the Express starting quarterback as early as this Saturday. We'll get all of Mark's thoughts and more on that when we come back right here on the Gary Parrish Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN.
Guests appear on the Smile Center Hotline. Now, back to the Gary Parrish Show, live from the Bluff Restaurant and Sports Bar Studios on 92.9 FM, ESPN. Today's special guest host, Jeffrey Wright.
Fortunato, of course, is the sports columnist for the Commercial Appeal. You can always follow him on Twitter at MGiannato. Brad, make him the big interview.
Award-winning writers, athletes, coaches, the biggest names in sports. It's the Gary Parrish Show Big Interview. Presented by Ruth's Chris Steakhouse in Memphis. Now on 92.9 FM ESPN.
Mark, let's start here. Now that we've seen the completion of the regular season and the conference tournament, how do you grade year one for Penny Hardaway?
I think I'll go with B plus, maybe. I'll say, like, I don't know. Maybe I'm inching, like, I'd inch towards an A if they make a run to New York in the NIT. You know, obviously, in terms of recruiting, it's an A. In terms of bringing the fans back, it's probably like an A minus. And then in terms of the product on the court, I'd say I'd give it like a B, just because, you know, ultimately they didn't win one of those, you know, any sort of big games. They didn't overachieve. They did kind of exactly what I thought they would do, kind of be on the bubble and show encouraging signs, and they played an entertaining style of basketball. And Penny showed that, you know, he showed that he has the coaching acumen to coach at the college level. He just didn't kind of, to me, he didn't get that signature win. That's what's preventing me from giving them an A right now. But you get to New York in the NIT, that gives you a chance to bump up that grade. So I'd say B plus. That's how I do it. But I'm willing to bet most people in Memphis would grade him higher than I would.
It is funny because Jeff was mentioning this when we were discussing on the show this morning, how, you know, we don't, not that we're like rolling our eyes, like that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard, but in terms of when you heard the post-game comments and Penny Hardaway was consistently talking about some of these early losses, particularly the losses to Texas Tech, particularly letting one get away at home against Cincinnati, LSU second half. That one, I felt like LSU kind of let Memphis back in the game. I really don't really count that one per se. The Temple game on the road, I felt like was not a great loss. But it is kind of funny to think about, as much as we kind of dismissed the whole tournament talk, if you really kind of change that Texas Tech game and perhaps change the Cincinnati game at home, they very much could be the team that's in it and not Temple.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you change, you know, really the flaw in their resume. Like, I was comparing resumes the past week or so just to figure out what it is that's preventing, because Memphis's net was so good. So I was like, what is it that's preventing them from truly being on the bubble? And it was the fact that in terms of those quadrant one and quadrant two wins, I mean, I think they ended up the year 4-12 in quadrant one and quadrant two games, including 2-8 or 2-9 after the loss to Houston in the tournament on Saturday in quadrant one games. Now compare that to Temple, who went 7-8 in quadrant one and quadrant two games, including a win over Houston. So really, I mean, because their net was so good and their strength of schedule was good, you show up for the first half against USF when you wasted Jeremiah's 41-point second half, and say you win either win the Cincinnati home game or you win the Texas Tech game. You know, just those two games, I think, puts you in, you know, an 11-12 seed type of situation. You're right. It's really Penny kind of talked about it at the beginning. It was funny, like at the beginning of the season when they'd have these close losses and you'd stand there and listen to Penny kind of lament like, oh, God, like, you know, like, and you'd, I'd be like, well, whatever. It's like, this isn't going to be the difference between a good, you know, an NCAA tournament bid or not. And it was. Penny was dead on. He knew that, you know, any one of those results could have put this team in the NCAA tournament. And, you know, to me, that's why, like I said, it's a B+, because they weren't able to get over the hump in one of those big games on the schedule. And so it'll be interesting to see how they do moving forward. And then, you know, even here in this NIT tournament, there's some decent teams in the NIT. And, you know, as we've seen in the past with Memphis, like getting to New York is no, you know, it's nothing to sniff at. Like it's hard to get to New York in the NIT, to get to that NIT Final Four, and it can really provide you a lot of momentum going into the offseason.
Well, especially now that they've changed the formatting, you've cut the tournament essentially in half down to the 32 teams. But now, essentially, you know, if you won the regular season conference tournament and you won the regular season in a conference, but you didn't win the conference tournament, you're one of those quality mid-major teams. Now you're automatically in this pool. So we're seeing a lot more competitive teams, and as you've mentioned, it's much more difficult to advance in the NIT. But really, I wanted to touch on something that you mentioned right there. Is that really the biggest black eye for this team this year? Is it some of the early starts where this team came out with no real energy and they would kind of look like polar opposites at times, where you'd see them one game and they weren't really all that consistent game to game? Is that kind of the biggest black eye for this season?
Yeah, I guess if you want to call it a black eye. I just think the one thing that was missing was just that signature win that you could point to. I mean, like the closest you got basically is the two UCF wins.
Yeah.
You know, when you blow out UCF at home twice, and probably the best one was this one this past week in the tournament. And, you know, like UCF's a good team, but it just didn't, you know, ultimately they didn't beat a ranked team this year. They didn't beat a top 25 team. UCF is no longer in the top 25, and I don't believe they were when the tournament started, when they beat them last week. So, yeah, that's the one thing Penny's that's left to be accomplished. But the thing I would say about this season is that it's convinced me that, you know, like I was probably on the fence in terms of what is Penny going to be like as an on-court coach. Like, I just didn't know. Like, I'd watched him coach high school and AAU, and it was hard. It's hard to gauge because his talent level was so much better than everyone he faced at those levels. But he proved to me this year that he can coach, and that bodes well for next year when the talent level goes up.
Yeah, I try to not overreact to specific games, but tell me if you think this is too far out of bounds. I really felt like the way that the Wichita State game played out on the road that Saturday, and you saw some of the decisions that Penny made and the way that they played a tight game on the road down the stretch, I try not to overreact too much, but I thought, like, man, he's going up against Greg Marshall. This is going to be that's the second time that he's beat what's considered to be one of the elite coaches in all of college basketball from a scheme standpoint and whatnot. And I was like, man, I just think he's going to be fine there. Do you feel like that was maybe too much of an overreaction? Because I am willing to admit that.
Well, I thought that Wichita State game was great in terms of, I mean, they fall behind early. It looked like it was going to go just like every other road game they played. And they had the moxie to get back in that game and hit big shots down the stretch. I'll give you an example, and it was from this weekend, from the Houston loss, where I think you saw Penny, the evolution of Penny as a coach. And it's, you know, he was getting out-coached for 30 minutes of that game. Kelvin Sampson had a much better game plan than Penny did. And basically said, you know what, we are not going to let Jeremiah get into the lane. And if he does, we're going to hammer him. And that's what they did. I mean, it took Jeremiah 24 shots to get his 23 points, and he did get to the line, but they just beat up Jeremiah and with their length and with their size. And what they also did is they were just abusing Memphis's bigs. I mean, Mike Parks and Kevin Davenport and Isaiah Maurice. I mean, the Houston bigs just dominated them. And then you saw over those last 10 minutes, Penny went small. I mean, and then Kelvin Sampson responded and went small as well, and ended up being a big mistake. And you saw just like how Penny adjusted midseason and sort of went away from the Tyler Harris and Alex Lomax look on the court together and went to, you know, an all-senior starting lineup. He also was, you know, in that moment, was able to adjust on the fly and goes with, you know, Alo, Jeremiah, Tyler, Antoine Jones, and Rainier. And it got him back in the game against Houston, that lineup. And so I was impressed with Penny's ability to adjust and his willingness to just, you know, his willingness, I think, and it's funny, I was talking to John Thompson III during the Tulane game about this because he was sitting next to me. And I think I think people were skeptical about, in terms of Penny, you know, being willing to not use his guy, so to speak. And what he did midway through the season is just said, you know what? You know, playing Alo and Tyler together and playing Jeremiah off the ball, like, this isn't working the way I want it to. And he just completely switched and moved Jeremiah back to where he was being used under Tubby Smith and went with all of basically Tubby Smith's guys and started winning games. And that, to me, showed a lot of, you know, guts, and bodes well for next year when the talent level is better. Just, you know, it seemed like Penny, you know, figured out a formula that would work best for this team. And it didn't matter that maybe Alex Lomax and Tyler Harris didn't get as much playing time, or, you know, Antoine Jones didn't get as much playing time. Penny just wanted to win. And over the course of the end of this season, he did that increasingly.
Mark Giannotto, of course, of the Commercial Appeal, joining us here on the Gary Parrish Show. Jeffrey sitting in for Gary. And then last question on the Tigers before we get into a little Manziel talk. What's going to be the expectations next year? Because obviously you got the number one player in the nation coming in. You have this outstanding recruiting class that's, you know, I think currently right now sixth in the nation according to the composite rankings. The schedule is going to be much tougher beginning next year, and enthusiasm is high. In your opinion, what should the realistic expectations be for this program next year?
Realistically, I think you look at what Cincinnati did this year. 25 wins, 26 wins, and a 7 seed in the tournament.
Yeah.
That, to me, as it's, you know, I preface that with let's see who else Penny adds late here. But say he only gets one more recruit. Say he gets either Lester Canones or Precious Achiuwa or Trenton Wofford. Like, I hope fans don't have unrealistic expectations for this team. Like, to be quite honest, as good as this recruiting class is, I don't think, like, if the season started tomorrow, I don't think this team would get picked first in the league, and I don't think it'd get picked second in the league. I think Houston and Cincinnati would still be 1 and 2. Now, I think Memphis would probably maybe slot in there at number 3, but that would be my opinion. And we'll see who they add here late. Maybe that will change things, but I think it's going to be a team just almost completely reliant on freshmen and sophomores. And, you know, except for like Duke and Kentucky, when that's the case, it can be tough, especially early. Like, you look at Memphis, what Memphis's schedule is going to look like next year. In the month of November, they're going to play Oregon in Portland. They're going to play Northeastern in Boston. They're going to go to Myrtle Beach in a pretty loaded field at a tournament there. And then mid-December, they're going to have to go to Tennessee. And then they're going to have to play Ole Miss in November as well at home. And we don't even know what else, you know, there's only 9 of the 13 games non-conference schedule. And, like, this team's going to take some time to come together, just like this year's team took some time to come together. So to project this team, like, I think it's unrealistic to expect them to be a top 10 or even maybe a top 20 team next year with this much youth. Now, I do think it's realistic to expect, like, I think the expectation is make the NCAA tournament. And then who knows what can happen from there.
Yeah, I mean, too.
So I would point to Cincinnati. Where Cincinnati is in the bracket this year, that would be my expectation from Memphis.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, if you look at the top 10 recruiting classes from last season, obviously you have Duke and Kentucky at 1 and 2. We know that those are a little bit different example, but some similar programs in terms of recruiting class and having to replace guys. Oregon was the number 3 class. We saw, obviously, with the Bowl injury, but, you know, they get in as a 12 seed. LSU is a 3 seed, and they've got other issues to worry about. Kansas was the 5 recruiting class, and they're in as a 4. UCLA doesn't even make the tournament. Maryland at 7, I believe, is a 6 seed. Texas doesn't make the tournament. Villanova is a 6-7 seed. Indiana doesn't make the tournament. Like, I think that's a very fair assessment of where they should be, because it's not like you're adding on top of another elite recruiting class for Memphis right now.
Yeah, no, and I think like they right now, for instance, they have a clear, you know, they need to add a shooter or two. Just look at, you know, just because you're adding the number one recruit in the country, like Like, and I know they've got DJ Jeffries, who, you know, I think his people, his family think he's a one and done type of guy. We'll see about that. I have, you know, I think he's more of a 2 or 3 year type guy. But like, look at like, you know, like Washington added Markelle Fultz and LSU added Ben Simmons. They didn't make the tournament with those guys. You know, just adding the number one recruit isn't enough. And luckily Memphis has more coming than just James Wiseman, but I just hope people don't put unrealistic expectations on this team. Like, this is not a Final Four team unless they add significantly more pieces. This is not a top 10 team unless they add significantly more pieces. It's not even probably the favorite to win the AAC unless they add a lot here late. But I do think it's realistic to expect the NCAA tournament drought for the program to end. That, to me, should be the expectation for the program, is get to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2014.
And then
that, to me, seems realistic.
And then, speaking of unrealistic expectations, what are your expectations for Johnny Manziel? As he now has officially, he's had his first practice. He is officially part of the Express. We've seen him wearing the 2. He's got the jersey. What are your expectations?
I just want him to be entertaining. I want the Express not to mess this up. Like,
yes,
this is a real chance for them to really like get the market. Like, they have not gotten this market on board with their product.
No.
And with Johnny Manziel here, this is a chance for them to really make an impression on Memphis. And I just hope, you know, I just hope they don't mess this up. Like Johnny Manziel, Johnny Manziel should be playing this weekend. Maybe not starting. You know, maybe you want to wait to start him, but he should be getting snaps this weekend. And if Mike Singletary's not comfortable with that, you go find a coach who is comfortable with that. Like, it just, to me, I want to see him out on the field. I mean, this is the biggest name in the league, and he's here in Memphis. And so, I know it seems like a lot to, you know, just have this guy come in on a Monday and then play a game on Sunday. But, you know, that might even be more exciting. Like, this is Johnny football. Just draw some plays up in the dirt and let him go to work.
Yeah. He's never been a playbook.
I don't know. I mean, maybe
one and five.
Like, it's not like he's going,
yeah, what are we
gonna
lose?
Like, he's been successful before this and you're going to mess up a good thing. Like, this team has been boring and unsuccessful. So just mix it up and let Johnny football do his thing.
Yeah, with all due respect to Brandon Silvers, and Lord knows the pedigree of Troy quarterbacks is long, and there are so many. But I mean, good God! Like, let me tell you how long it would take me I would be like Houston Nutt when he got Jeremiah Masoli from Oregon after he got kicked off the team. I would have pretended that there was a quarterback battle for like an hour. And then I would have just said, hey, boys, he's going to go out and be throwing the pill. Like, at the end of the day, like, you need about 4 plays. Like, have zone left, zone right. And then basically what I'm just going to say is
run out of the pocket.
Yeah, block long enough to where the rushers get upfield so he can step up and get outside the pocket. And then everybody run to the sideline. And then he's going to make throws. Like, that would be my offense.
Well, and I'll be real interested to hear what they have to say tomorrow. Because, like I said, I think this is a big moment for them in the market in that, like, be honest. Like, if you're really not going to play him this weekend, like, say it. Say
yes.
It right now. You know,
so that we don't buy tickets.
Don't have a bunch of people pay money to come to the
yes.
Liberty Bowl and then have him not play.
Oh,
and then
God.
you're gonna tick off all these new customers that you have. But my suggestion would be like, and I think this will be a league, you know, like the way this thing works, I sense with AAF, like, ultimately, I don't even know if it's going to be Singletary's call. I think if the league wants Johnny Manziel to play, Johnny Manziel is going to play.
God, fingers crossed. Please,
you know?
Dear
and so
God.
Hopefully the league is, you know, realizes, you know what? Like, especially, like, honestly, like, they have a national TV game. I think it's their last game of the year is on CBS.
Yes.
And, like, to me, you'd want to get Manziel some warm-up games before he's on national TV again. You know, these next couple weeks, it'll be a big story here in Memphis. Mm-hmm. And I think his first start or first appearance will be big news around the country. But ultimately, most people around the country are going to be focused on the NCAA tournament. And so you've got 4 games left in the season. If you don't play, you know, I just feel like You got to play them. I really hope they do. Because it's, I mean, like, I wasn't planning to go to any more of these express games, and now I'm definitely going.
Yeah, no,
I want to see Manziel.
Now you're getting me angry thinking about if Singletary tries to do football coach, like, he's got to earn it. No, he doesn't. Just play him.
that would be insane. If he really does that, I literally, my what I would say to Express is if he does not want to play Johnny Manziel,
go find a coach who will.
Because, like, he hasn't been good enough to, like, you know, it's not like we're talking about Bill Belichick.
Yes. I mean, good God. He's been fired from everywhere he's ever been as a head coach. Mark, you're the best, my man. Appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks, guys.
That is Mark Giannotto.
I'm with him. This is an NFL Network game, by the way. It's 7 o'clock on Sunday at the Liberty Bowl.
I misspoke earlier saying Saturday. I got the schedule in my head mixed up from
this weekend. Like, I'm going to bring Jake, and we're going to go to the silly game because I haven't been to a game because it's been 40 below zero out there, it seems like. But the weather hopefully will be warm, and the quarterback will hopefully be Johnny Manziel.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best point. If Mike Singletary's not going to play him, like, do the move that the presidents do when you find someone that doesn't
executive order.
Yeah, well, just like, yeah, like yeah. If you're like with Nixon, like if you're not going to fire these guys, like the Saturday night massacre, like just find, like, I'm literally going to keep firing people until someone goes, I'm going to play Johnny. Yeah. Great. You're hired. You got the gig. We'll discuss all this and more with Jeff Calkins when we come back right here on the Gary Parrish Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN.
Here at 92.9 FM, ESPN, we realize it's that special time of your life where you don't do much of anything except do brackets. And women, well, they like brackets too. But for dudes, it's a special time to focus on winning, on the majesty that is the college basketball tournament, and a time where they get vasectomies. Get in the book at Horseshoe Bracket Challenge, presented by Papa John's now at 92.9ESPN.com. And don't forget that bag of frozen peas there, Tiger.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.